Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
And if you hurry, you might want to get one of the two remaining lines. We're going to start out visiting with Ed and Kathleen on just another nice Sunday morning. I tell you what, I guess only real unhappy people out there, the deer hunters, that really wish it was a little colder. And I guess we ranchers that were really wishing we would get a little bit more rain about this time of year. But, you know, beyond that, it is just an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous Sunday morning out there. Hoping you're planning to spend some of it outside. Hope you're going to be working in the garden or maybe out taking a walk in nature or just out there breathing some good, clean air. I tell you what, it's if there's any, there are a handful, I guess, of good things that have come out of the COVID mess. But I think a lot of people are appreciating even more how much fresh air really matters. I don't think we typically dine out at lunch, and I don't think I've eaten inside of a restaurant more than a handful of times. Love those patios, love the open spaces, and boy, days like this just beg for you to be outside. So hope you're going to get outside and enjoy. Let's get started with phone calls. Ed is up first. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning. I have a question on asparagus.
Yes, sir.
Mine are all looking like ferns. When do I cut them back, and when do I harvest?
If they have not frozen by about the 1st of January, that's when I cut mine back because, of course, the part we eat is what gets up and makes the ferns if you don't pick it. So typically, if we have a mild winter, and this one's certainly starting out mild, the asparagus can actually begin producing edible spears sometime shortly after the 1st of the year, and you want to just have those old ferns out of the way. Now, if we get a freeze between now and the 1st of the year, as soon as they've totally turned brown, go ahead and cut them off at that point. But if they haven't browned out by January 1st, that's when I kind of put it on my agenda to go ahead and cut them back. Now, harvesting, how long have your plants been in the ground?
About 3 years.
Okay, so they should be well established by now. Harvesting, we begin just as soon as the plants begin to come out, and we harvest every single sprout that comes up. Don't let any of them go to, you know, make the big fern, so to speak, because when you do that, they really stop producing very many new sprouts. So you will snip, break off. They're so crisp, I just snap them off, and a lot of them get eaten before I even get out of the garden. But we harvest every single one, and let's say you get called out of town for a weekend or something, you come home and some of them have gotten too big to eat, go ahead and cut them off anyway, because that's what's going to keep the plants producing. Each year we can produce, or we can pick for a little bit longer period of time. Yours have been in the ground for about 3 years, so you can probably pick every shoot that comes out for 8 to 10 weeks. After that, you'll stop picking any of them and just let them go to make the fern so they can resupply the roots and start, you know, into the next phase of their growth. So in summary, if we don't get a freeze, it freezes them back. Cut them back around the 1st of January. If we get a freeze, freezes them back, go ahead and cut them back anytime. Start harvesting as soon as they come out and just mark it on the calendar. Harvest for about 8 to 10 weeks and enjoy.
Thank you very much. You have a nice day.
And you enjoy your asparagus. Thank you, sir. All right, Kathleen is up next. Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning there. I'm calling about the infamous St. Augustine grass that everyone calls about.
Oh, yes.
I have a 40-year-old established lawn on not much dirt. We're just north of the airport.
Uh-huh.
And I watered it all summer, and small mounds of dark soil, little piles, they look like coffee grounds.
Uh-huh.
All over in the backyard.
I used
soil activator a couple weeks ago. I suspect insect beetle mischief.
Nope.
But
nope.
I want to know what to do this week and who could possibly help with that.
You don't need any help at all. Those are called earthworm castings. Those are what earthworms leave in your yard. And if you have lots of those little mounds, it means you have lots of earthworms. And that is a very good thing for your yard, not a bad thing in any way, form, or fashion.
Okay, so the grass looks terrible. I mean, it's about one-third green at this point, and, you know, through the last month or so. It looks very damaged. What can I do now?
And when was the last time you fertilized?
Well, I did the soil activator, but not the fertilizer 2 weeks ago.
Okay, you need to put some fertilizer on. Soil activator is a microbial stimulant, but it doesn't contain any of the basic nutrients that your grass really needs to get through the winter and get ready to make its burst of growth in the spring. So I would, you can use Medina, Maestro Grow, Nature's Creation. There are a lot of good organic fertilizers out there. You do not need to look for anything that says winterizer. That's a ploy by the chemical people to get you to buy different kinds of fertilizers, which is totally unnecessary. So I would just, get your organic fertilizer, feed not just your grass, but everything in your landscape, your trees, your shrubs, and ground covers. Is the grass continuing to turn brown, or is this damage that occurred a little earlier in the fall?
It's yellow. It's not even brown.
Go out and lift up on a couple of the yellow blades and see if they remain fairly firmly attached to the runner underneath. If that yellowed blade separates easily from the runner, and if it looks a little brown down at the base where it came away from the runner, that could be a sign of brown patch fungus disease. If that's the case, then I would put out some whole ground cornmeal, about 10 pounds per 1,000 square feet. But I suspect your grass is just hungry. I would continue to water through the winter. You don't have to water as often, probably about every 2 weeks. If we get a frost and it browns out totally, then you can probably go to every 3 weeks. But do continue watering, because St. Augustine needs water on a year-round basis. But at this point, all I'm going to tell you it really needs to be done is just get some good fertilizer on it and maintain your good watering program. Put out at least an inch of water each time you water. Like I say, just put that on the calendar to do about every 2 weeks, and you should be in great shape.
What about some compost? Did that help?
Compost is always a good idea. Not a thick layer, but quarter to half an inch. That's other than fertilizing, that's about the single best thing you can do. You can do it any time between about now and about the end of April, but the sooner you do it, the faster your grass is going to respond.
Okay, so I need helping hands with this. Is there someone you could recommend that would put down the right stuff?
I'll tell you who will put down the fertilizer, and that would be Sam Sitterly. His company's called Green Grow Organics. Compost spreading is a very laborious thing. And, when I was growing up, spent from about the time I was 5 years old working in my grandfather's greenhouse. And whenever we needed some laboring help, my uncle knew the football coach at the high school a little ways away, and he'd call the coach, and the coach would always know a couple of strong young men that needed to make a little money. And that's where we got our labor to do things like spreading compost. But be careful, get a price up front. I've heard some real horror stories. I talked to somebody earlier this week that without asking, the price, he paid a company to spread, I think, about 8 yards of compost, which would be less than 2 truckloads, and they charge him like $2,500. Be very careful of anybody with a pickup truck and a plastic sign. I would recommend, I think, some of the best compost out there you can get from Stone and Soil Depot. Be sure and specify you don't want biosolids compost, but finding the labor to do it, unless you have a teenage son or grandson, like I said, we always talked to the high school coach who knew some kids that needed the money and needed the workout. Beyond that, you might talk to your neighbors or other people and see who they've had good luck in doing it.
Okay, terrific. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You do the same, Kathleen. I appreciate the call. Thank you. Goodbye. All right, let me get a quick break in here, and then we will pick right up where we left off. I believe Lydia is up next. You know, talking about fertilizer, talking about good year-round fertilizer, Medina makes one of the very best ones out there and one of the most readily available ones, too. They call it Growing Green. It's certified organic. It's got all the good stuff in there, fortified with extra iron and extra humates and just all kinds of good things. It's great for literally everything in your landscape, as well as your vegetable garden, your flower beds. It's one of Medina's most popular products. On golly, we go through a truckload, which is 24 pallets. I think we go through that about every 5 weeks around our place. So, very good stuff. Medina also makes good quality liquid fertilizers. They make the Soil Activator and the Medina Plus, which is like an improved soil activator. And not to mention all the other products that they really package rather than make them, but they do liquid and dry humates. They do orange oil. They do molasses. They do liquid seaweed. If it says Medina on the label, it's quality, it's natural, it comes from right here in Texas, Medina Agriculture.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone calls. Actually, Kathleen was the first to call, so it's going to be Kathleen and Lydia and Cliff. Kathleen, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question on cyclamen.
Yes, ma'am.
Temperature, will they take freezing temperature?
They will take it down into the upper teens without damage. Now, if it's going to get much below 20, and if it's going to stay there for very long, I would cover them. But 22, 23, 24 degrees, not a problem. And we rarely get colder than that here in San Antonio. So they're probably by far our best wintertime flower for the shade. And this time of year, you know, they'll take a little bit of sun, but if you have them in too much sun, well, as it starts to warm up in the spring, they won't last as long. But in bright shade, golly, they'll go all the way up till early summer. And unless we get very, very unusually cold weather, they will not have any problem with their winters.
What about some other flowers? I have violas will take the freeze. But what some other flowers will take the freeze?
Well, violas and pansies, of course, are both sun lovers that will take the freeze.
Yeah.
Then there is a whole group of plants, which includes snapdragons, dianthus, petunias, alyssum. All of those plants, if we have a cold winter, they don't have any problem with the cold. But they bloom in the fall, and then if it gets real cold, they continue to grow through the winter with a lot of flowers. And then they're just a solid mass of flowers in the spring, and stock also falls in that group. So snapdragon stock, petunias, dianthus, if we have a mild winter, they will continue to bloom all winter long. And like I say, if it gets cold, it doesn't bother the plants. They just slow down on their blooming in January or so when we typically have the most cold. Now, in addition, there are a couple of others that will take moderate cold, probably down to 25 degrees without damage, and that includes things like that cobalt blue lobelia and the alyssum, which comes in white and rose and purple color. Alyssum and the lobelia both will take a lot of cold, but they won't take it down quite as cold as the other ones will. If you really want to have flowers every day of the winter months, your Johnny Jump Ups and your bigger pansies are the things you can count on most.
Well, I want to compliment your nursery. I called several weeks ago. I needed the Johnny Jump Ups and pansies, etc., and petunias. And when I arrived, the lady had everything I ordered in a box ready to be picked up. Can you imagine this? I know all your listeners will appreciate this, that you have service.
You know, we've had our business here for 39 years. We're having our best year ever. So it's just amazing, this old-fashioned idea of service and quality. It seems to still work in today's world. I love doing business with independent businessmen. You know, I drive to Comfort to do business with the lumberyard and hardware store up there rather than to go to Home Depot down the street. And we really appreciate it when people like you notice and thank us for it. But it's our pleasure to do so. I hope we never let you down in that regard.
Oh, and one other subject, and I'll let you go. I received a letter in the mail to cut my sprinkling system off for November through March. Now you're telling us that we should water St. Augustine all winter, right?
Yes, ma'am. You should water all of your grass all winter. Here's what they are trying to tell you, and you know, it's a screwy way to do things, but it's the way that Saws does. They determine the sewer rate they charge on your bill by how much water you use in the winter months, December, January, February. And in the years that we have good rains, you may not need to water very much. But this winter is starting off a very dry winter and supposedly we're moving into a La Nina pattern, which means we will probably stay dry. And so if you want your grass to live, unfortunately, even though it will make your sewer bill a little bit higher for the next 12 months, you've got to water. Now, you know, some folks that have the room and have a big roof collect rainwater, and they save that to use during this time of year. But you should definitely not stop watering, but just you should realize that be conservative. Water as much as you need to and no more, because Oz is gonna be charging your sewer bill based on how much water you use for the next 3 months, and that's what that letter's all about.
Yeah, do you think once a week is sufficient?
I think it cools down, once every 2 to 3 weeks is sufficient. Once a week should be sufficient, you know, even when the very warmest weather. But right now, probably every 2 weeks, if we get into, you know, our typical colder weather in late December and January, then once every 3 weeks will be enough. But definitely don't stop watering completely.
Well, thanks for your information, Bob. We appreciate you. Bye-bye.
Well, we appreciate you, Kathleen. And if you have the good Lord's ear, tell him we could use some more rain, and then we won't have to water that much. But it's sure dry. I know up in the hill country, a lot of us are going to be buying a lot of hay this winter if it doesn't turn around. But I'm not real optimistic, but like I say, don't water too often, but water thoroughly when you water, and hopefully we'll get a little rain mixed in every now and then, Kathleen. And you get out and have a wonderful Sunday.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Goodbye. Lydia is up next, and then it'll be Cliff. Good morning, Lydia. Hi, Lydia. Are you there?
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
It's just a beautiful day, and I got my exercise unloading a beautiful semi full of plants this morning, so I'm wide awake and going strong this morning. Hopefully you're just enjoying your second cup of coffee and off to a little more quiet Sunday.
Yes. I have a question. I heard the lady talking about the water.
Yes.
I thought, I had been made to understand that if you hand water, you can.
You can water. No one is prohibited from watering. You have to follow watering days. If you're using a sprinkler system, you can hand water. You can hand water anytime. But what she was asking about, Saws bases how much they're going to charge you. You know, they do a monthly sewer charge on your water bill.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that is based on how much water you use during the winter months. The idea behind it is grass is supposed to rain in the winter, and grass doesn't need as much water. The landscape doesn't need as much water. Unfortunately, this year it is very dry, and we're going to have to continue watering. But whether it's hand-watered by the sprinkler system, they're going by what your water meter says. So you're not, you know, you're still going to be charged if you're hand watering. Mm-hmm. But as far as the legality under drought stages, yes, you can hand water. At least in this drought stage,
yes,
you can hand water anytime.
Okay. My question was, I purchased one of the smart pot fabric planters from the store.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I wanted to put onions in that.
Yes, ma'am.
And potatoes. Can I do, it's a 20-gallon one. Do you think that would be enough for both?
No, I think you're going to need to do let me put it this way. If you want to do both, you could do in that size, you could do about 15 or 20 onions and about probably 3 potato plants. I don't know how much you like potatoes and you like onions, but if you, it's not going to give you a real big crop. Let's just say I usually plant 200 or 300 onions and about 30-foot double row of potatoes. So, you can certainly. Yeah, well, then.
Last year I planted some, rather late, but it was like in one of those flower pots.
Yeah.
And they did grow, but not very much. I got about maybe 10 of them. So I wanted to try this fabric planter and see if I could do that in that.
Oh, they will grow even better in the fabric planter than they will in a flower pot. It's a great place to grow. It's just, I don't know if you'll be able to grow as many as you would like, but, if I were doing that, I would kind of, just make an invisible line down the middle and just plant your onions on one side and your potatoes on the other. Or if you say, well, I like potatoes better than onions, and you 2/3 potato, 1/3 onions, or however you like to do it. They are not going to interact with each other. And unlike sweet potatoes, which I grow in a fabric pot just because otherwise they may grow anywhere in the garden, your Irish potatoes, red skin potatoes, whatever you want to call them, they grow right at the base of the potato plant, as you know. So they're not going to try to take over, and they will cohabitate, shall we say, quite well.
Now, how do you plant sweet potato?
Sweet potato you will plant later in the season. We normally plant our other potatoes, or red skin potatoes, we normally plant in February. We normally plant our sweet potatoes in about May or so. And the way you do that is you get a sweet potato, a live sweet potato at the grocery store, probably at Whole Foods or Natural Grocers is my favorite of the organic places. You suspend it in a jar of water like most of us did as kids and let it start, making the little vines. When the vines get about 6 inches long, you take a sharp knife and you just take a little section of potato along with that vine. It's called a slip. And that's what we plant to grow our sweet potatoes from. And like I say, we do that when the soil really warms up, typically about May or so.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know that. I think that's what I'm going to do. Just wait until it's seasoned. But
sweet potatoes will spread out all over the place, and.
Yeah.
Unlike the red skin potatoes, red skin potatoes, the plant's going to kind of die back as we get into summer months, and you might as well go ahead and harvest the potatoes. The sweet potato just keeps growing and growing and growing, and a sweet potato never really gets ripe, so to speak. It just keeps getting bigger. So if you want small sweet potatoes, you can pick them, you can dig them a little earlier. Biggest sweet potato I've ever seen weighed 43 pounds. I think that'd be a little big for most people's ovens. So you just, by midsummer, early fall, you just start probing around with your finger and see how big those tubers are and harvest them at the size that you would enjoy cooking and enjoying.
Is it preferred to plant the sweet potato in the ground then?
You can do it either way. When you plant them in the ground, the sweet potatoes might develop 5 feet or 10 feet away from the central plant. So sometimes you have to dig up half the garden to find out where your sweet potatoes are.
Okay.
I grow the sweet potatoes. In the fabric pot, I don't have nearly as much space that I have to go hunting for the potatoes. So that's why I grow the redskins in the ground, but then I grow the sweet potatoes in the fabric pot just because they can't go and hide on me.
And the container should be full to the top with the whatever dirt I put in there.
I get it real close. Yeah, I get it real close because, in a flower pot, you want to leave it down a little bit just so when you water, it'll collect and soak in. But those sides on the fabric pots don't really stand up very well. So I fill them, and then, of course, the soil settles a little bit over the growing season. But when I start out, I have them full to the brim.
Okay, all right. Well, I thank you so much for your information, and God bless you, and thank you so much for your service that you provide
to us.
Well,
it is my great pleasure, and keep in mind now, if you're using the good organic fertilizers and all, you never have to replace that soil. You use the same soil year after year after year in that fabric pot.
So it
just keeps getting better, so don't feel like you have to dump it out and start over ever.
So I have to put fertilizer in that soil?
I do a little dry fertilizer when I plant, and then while they're growing, I'll hit them with the liquid fertilizer. My dry fertilizer carries them for the first couple of months, and after that, I start fertilizing every couple of weeks with a liquid product like Has to Grow or something like that. Just the more you fertilize. I'm sorry?
What kind of dry fertilizer, what brand or what kind?
Any of the good organic ones. Medina makes a good one they call Growing Green. Like to say, Nature's Creation makes a good one they call Premium Lawn Food, but it's also great for the garden. Maestro Grow makes a product they call Texas Tea, T-E-E. Any of those are great organic fertilizers, and I go shopping and see where I get the best price. And, of course, for me, I get the broken bags when the guys get a little careless with the forklift and they rip up a bag. That's what goes home to my garden.
Oh,
that's usually Medina. What's
okay?
I get the leftover plants and the broken bags, but that's not a bad thing.
No, not at all. Yeah. Okay. Well, you have a wonderful day, sir.
You too, Lydia. Thanks so much for the call. My pleasure.
Yeah,
goodbye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let me get a little break out of the way here, and Cliff will be up next, and we just go right on from there. I get to talk to you about the Freeze Miser. And once again, if you've never heard of this little device, something that I learned about last year, they've been around a little bit longer, but they're mainly used up in the northern part of the country where the temperatures get extremely cold. But this is it's just one of the most clever gadgets I've ever seen. No batteries, no wires, no electricity. It's based on some good chemistry and some good physics. And it's a little device that you screw onto your hydrants. If you're worried about your hydrants freezing and breaking in the winter months, I know living up in the country like I do, for most of my life, I've gone out and turned those hydrants on to drip whenever it's going to get really, really cold. And I've had a couple of faucets freeze and break anyway. Well, the Freeze Miser takes care of that. You screw this little device onto the hose, onto the hydrant, rather, and you turn the water on. Nothing comes out. It just sits there. It's not wasting a drop of water, but it senses when the temperature of the water in the hydrant gets down to 40 degrees, it automatically starts dripping just a little bit. If it gets really cold, it drips a little bit more, just enough to keep the faucet from freezing, and when it warms up, it stops dripping. It's just what could be simpler. Think how much water you waste when you turn that on at 9 o'clock at night, and it stays dripping till 9 o'clock the next morning. Probably only needs to drip for about 2 hours during the night. Well, with the Freeze Miser, it only drips during the time that you really need it to drip. They're just really, really ingenious. Like I say, they can be used on a cattle water trough. What I do is I put a little Y connector on there. I put my Freeze Miser on one side and leave the garden hose on the other side. And, that way I just don't worry. And so many times last winter when it got below freezing up in the hill country where I live, I'd look out in the morning and hear it's drip, 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 drip. No freeze problems. Afternoon when I go back home, it shut itself off automatically. Freeze Miser is a neat device. You can go online, learn more about them at freezemiser.com. They are sold by better hardware stores, by nurseries. Again, if you're up in the hill country, I know you find them at Bonards here in San Antonio. We keep them. I think most of the better nurseries have them on the shelves. If not, they should. It's called the Freeze Miser, M-I-S-E-R.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, it's a beautiful Sunday morning out there. We're talking gardening, and I'm going to talk to Cliff and Robert and Vicki, and Cliff is up first. Good morning, Cliff.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
My question is about leaf miners on my Meyer lemon and my Mexican lime plant.
They're this year. They're the worst I've ever seen this year.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. You know, they're a nuisance. They're not a health threat to the plant, but they are a real nuisance. The problem is that, they're inside the leaf, so it's very hard to kill them. I don't know why they're so bad this year. There's a little wasp out there that actually, and I've seen Disney actually over at Epcot, they took pictures, as only Disney can do, with this little wasp walking around on the leaf, locating the leaf miner, and then in effect killing it by laying an egg inside of it, puncturing the surface of the leaf and laying an egg inside of it. So normally we don't see many of them because of this wonderful little wasp, but apparently the weather or something has set their population back, and I'm seeing more leaf miners than I've ever seen. Now, the one systemic product that you can use if you like would be neem, N-E-E-M, neem oil. is both an insecticide and a fungicide, and it's made from a Brazilian tree. It's a, you know, very safe natural product.
Yes.
What I think we will probably be doing is waiting until the lemons and limes are ripe. And I mean, this stuff is it's safe, but again, anything that kills bugs, I don't especially want to eat it. So what we're probably going to do with our citrus is when we pick this year's crop of lemons and limes, then we're going to make two or three sprayings with neem to see if we can't get rid of these guys. Now, what happens ultimately, the leaf miner turns into a little bit different creature. It drops out of the leaf and goes down into the soil, where it goes through a different life stage, and then it comes back, turns into a creature that flies around, and the whole thing starts all over again. Over the winter months, I think putting out some beneficial nematodes will be a real good idea to kill the life stage that is in the soil at that point. But what we're going to do, like I say, is pick our fruit for this year, do two, three sprayings with neem, but not lose any sleep. We'll keep up our fertilizing. We'll keep up our good care on the citrus because, like I say, this really isn't life-threatening. It's just ugly. So that is sort of the long and the short of the citrus leaf miner.
Okay, I've been removing the leaves and getting those out of the way. So
that's fine. That's fine. But I've seen some trees where that would mean taking every leaf off the tree. But
yeah.
Dispose of the leaves. Don't just put them in the compost pile. Physically, throw them in the burn pile or seal them up in a plastic bag and send them off to the landfill. I don't recommend doing that with most leaves, but the ones that have the leaf miners in them, it'd be good to totally dispose of them.
I appreciate the help.
I appreciate the call. You have a wonderful Sunday, Cliff. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Certainly. Goodbye. Robert's up next. Good morning, Robert. Robert dropped off. How dare him do that? Well, call back if your phone gave up on you, Robert, and we'll talk to Vicki instead. Good morning, Vicki.
Morning. So embarrassed about my question. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine, and don't be embarrassed. I taught freshman biology, I always found that if a student thought it was a stupid question, at least 90% of the audience wanted an answer to that. So give me your question.
That's true. Well, I almost gave an alias, how embarrassed I am. So I broke my back last year building this beautiful raised bed stone butterfly garden.
Okay.
And then at the end of the year, I broadcast marigold and zinnia seed, from the deadheads. Uh-huh. And in the springtime, these little plants came up, and I thought they were marigolds. And basically, I have no idea how I did it, but I have the best crop of ragweed I've ever seen in my life. It's about waist high, and I can't see any of my perennials of my butterfly, and it's that bad.
Uh-huh.
So I'm calling to see if you have any irrigation advice.
Well,
other than back breaking again.
I'm afraid your best bet is to try to pull it before it totally goes to seed. Unfortunately, a lot of it's probably already making seed. You can also just cut it off at ground level. It typically dies out. Ragweed is usually an annual unless we just have no winter at all. So if you would prefer, you can just cut it off and dispose of the tops in the compost pile or somewhere before it has a chance to make seed everywhere. If it sprouts out, that just depends on what the weather does. You can always hit it with a little vinegar and orange oil that will cut it back. But I would either cut it off or pull it out just because it makes a huge amount of seed. And, of course, it releases plenty of pollen in the air. And whereas nice plants have nice little round pollen grains that don't bother anything, if you looked at the pollen grain under a microscope of ragweed, it's this little spike-covered round ball that looks like that old mason chain they used to fight with in the Middle Ages. And that's why it just tears up your allergies so much. But, I'd either cut it off or pull it up, and you don't have to do it all the same day. Take it easy on that back, and don't just get it done before they start making all the little seeds that go everywhere and start the
cycle
over.
Will do. I have one more embarrassing question.
Go right ahead.
So I tried, one of my experiments this year is cover crop, And I did some turnip seed cover crop in my veggie bed. And then I went and planted my garlic in the bed, and I totally forgot I planted them both in the same bed. And now I'm worried that the turnip cover crop is going to overtake the garlic. Should I pull up all those seedlings?
Only if they, you know, become an issue. Turnips, you know, they're one of those things that you can enjoy the greens, you can enjoy the bulb itself. But I, you know, they should, unless they get so big that they're shading the garlic out, they should get along okay in the garden. Neither one is really going to affect the other. So only if one of them gets a little too vigorous, and at that point it goes out of the garden and into the stew pot.
I hope my feeble mind helps somebody else today. Thank you.
Well, believe me, I've heard far stranger questions than that. be not embarrassed. You're just helping a lot of people that that were afraid to call and ask a question that's on their mind. So you get out and have a great Sunday, Vicki. I appreciate
you. Thank you. God bless you.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Goodbye. All right, guess I better do my last break of the hour, and then we'll get back to more phone calls. So I have a couple of open lines. Grab one if you like. You know the number, 210-599-5555. I get to talk about Wild Birds Unlimited, and that's always so much fun. And Kyle wants to remind you, they've got several tips to help you do what's right by your birds, so to speak, and just make the fall more fun. But he wants to remind you that birds also change their diets in the winter months. A lot of their diet switches over to high fat and protein things, and that's what they've got suet for. Wild Birds Unlimited has bunches of different kinds of suet and very inexpensive suet feeders that you can use to offer it to the birds in. They also have a winter blend of seeds for, you know, black oil sunflower and things like that that the birds need for that extra warmth in the winter months. It's just you don't just do the same thing year-round in your garden. You don't just do the same thing year-round with your birds. And Wild Birds Unlimited totally understands this and will help you do right by your birds, so to speak. You know, they've also going to make your Christmas shopping a little easier as well. They put together some great gift packages that contain everything that someone would need to get started with bird feeding. All you need to do is put a bow on it and put it under the tree for them. And by the way, now through Thanksgiving, 20% off your total bill, everything in the store. They call this the Black Friday sale, and they're stretching it out all the way up to the week after Thanksgiving. So just many, many good reasons to go see Wild Birds Unlimited. They're open 7 days a week. They're out there in the shopping center at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner Road, right there on the little section that faces Northwest Military. If you've not been, you need to get by and see our friends at Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening and to the phone calls. It's going to be Mike and Kid and Christine, and Mike is up first. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Bob. This old damp, foggy weather is about to get Charlie down.
Well, I wish it just turned into a nice liquid stream and come floating down, but, you know, we just don't have any choice in the matter.
Well, it will. It'll come about. Yeah. I'm just sitting here waiting for the sunshine. I have a couple of questions. One, Bob, I had talked to you before about a tree I have, a little tree maybe 7 feet tall. Excuse me. It's what I call an anacahuita. A Mexican sweet olive. It has maybe 5 or 6, 7 shoots coming out right at the very bottom. And I wanted to trim those off and propagate them. And I believe you said wait till November. How would I best do that?
Well, you want to be sure that it is mature wood, and you're probably not going to use the whole shoot. You're probably going to use just about, I normally keep the cuttings to about 4, maybe 5 inches long, strip off the lower leaves. The best thing you know, good coarse sand, like decayed granite or something like that, is a good rooting medium. And the white volcanic material they call perlite, P-E-R-L-I-T-E. Both of those are good medium, good media for rooting hardwood cuttings like that. So I take the cuttings, soak them in liquid seaweed and water combination, soak them for about 30 minutes or so. Put them in the rooting medium in an 8-inch pot. You can put probably 8 or 10 cuttings to the pot. Keep them bright, but no direct sun. Keep them, protect them from freezing and keep that medium moist. And by spring, at least a percentage of them should have rooted out for you. Normally, it takes about 3 months for hardwood cuttings to root over the winter months, but you should be pretty successful at it.
How long does it take, roughly?
Usually 3 to 4 months.
3 to 4 months. I have perlite, but I do not have any of the sand. What type of sand were you saying?
Any coarse sand, sandblasting sand, or even granite sand. But if you have perlite, that's all you need.
Well, perlite, they tend to, things tend to fall over. There's not enough beef to the stuff to keep them from falling over.
Well, you need to stick your cutting a little further down in. You know, I tend to root usually in a pot that's about at minimum of 6 inches deep. And a woody cutting like this, I'm going to probably put 2 inches of the stem down into the perlite and 3 inches above that. And if they're falling over, you're probably just not putting them deeply enough into the perlite. Strip off the lower leaves so you're putting a clean stem. But stick them well down in the perlite and be careful, you know, in moistening it that you're not just, you know, sending them a too strong a blast of water, and they should stand up just fine.
Okay, well, I got that down. I do want to ask you here, a few weeks ago you mentioned something about, I didn't get it exactly, but I thought you said cedar side to kill or repel roaches and scorpions and snakes and spiders.
Right. There are several different cedar oil repelling products out there. Cedar side is one. Different companies put them up in, you know, under different names. Cedar repel, cedar side, and you will find both the dry granules and you'll find the liquid. I think the liquid is a little more effective, but perhaps doesn't last quite as long as the granular form does. But they're obviously totally safe. There's absolutely no harm to them at all. But they do a pretty good job of repelling fleas, repelling lots of different noxious creatures, including roaches and scorpions. And to some extent, they even repel reptiles.
Okay. Spiders also?
Nah, there's not much that runs off spiders. I've heard coconut oil will, but spiders are a whole different group of creatures. They're arachnids. There's not a lot that really repels them. Cedar may have a slight effect because, of course, spiders are closely related to scorpions, and it does help repel scorpions. But I'm sure not going to make any promises on the spiders. I haven't found anything yet that really works well. If it is a web spinning spider, it's probably a friend because they're capturing insects. But if there are any web makers that you want to get rid of, you can just simply spray the webs with ammonia, and it'll dissolve that web, and the spider will have to go elsewhere. But spiders are, even though they're your friends, they can be a nuisance with all their web building. So good luck with that one.
Well, okay, I don't mind the spiders, except I did kill a few that looked like brown recluse.
Yeah,
I didn't want to take a chance with them. How about rosemary oil?
Rosemary oil is pretty good material. Be careful not to get too much of it on your plants or it can burn.
Well, I'm thinking about around the edge of my tool shed.
Around your tool shed, that would be just fine. In fact, you can mix cedar oil and rosemary oil together.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening on it's a humid day, but, you know, it's shorts and t-shirt weather, so that's okay with me. It doesn't have to be cold to make me happy, just glad we're away from the 90 and 100-degree weather. But let's get back to your questions, and did Mike have another question Don?
Yeah, Bob, I have a comment. Maybe okay. It's better for Dr. Kirby, but a couple of nights in a row, I had my suet feeders down on the ground, my black oil sunflower seed, my mealworms feeder was all on the ground. And so I started bringing them in at night. Then I set me out a trap, and I got the cutest little old gray fox you ever wanted to see.
Yes, sir.
The question I had about it, or the comment, is, did that booger climb the trees and get these suet feeders and other bird feeders down?
Foxes can climb. Coyotes cannot, but foxes can climb, and you will occasionally see a fox pretty far up in a tree. Now, they don't have the claws that dig in. They can't go up a tree like a bobcat or a house cat can, but they could be responsible. If they just were down on the ground, that would be one of the culprits. The most likely culprit are the blasted raccoons, but they usually not only knock things down but tear things up. So possibly, yes, could be a fox. More likely, I'd say, is probably raccoons.
I was expecting a raccoon because that had happened before, but I have not had a coon in a while, and it happened to be just when the fox was around, and I figure I have seen one climb a tree up about 20 feet. But
now the red fox will do that. The gray fox, not so much, but all of them can climb, so they are very definitely high on the list of suspects.
Well, I didn't shoot it. My wife didn't want me to shoot it, so I let it go, and it ran down the sidewalk about 20 or 30 feet, stopped, sat down, and turned around and looked at me.
Well, they're cute. In my book, pretty is as pretty does, and they're not high on my target list, but I just assume they weren't around the yard, so they get transported to a far edge of the property if they get into my traps. But again, I'll take them over coons and some other troublemakers at any time. So
yes, sir.
You got to see a pretty part of nature. Just of course, always be very, very careful in handling them, because they are one of the prime culprits when it comes to spreading rabies around.
Rabies, so, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you for listening to me, and I'll let somebody else get in on the air.
That's great. Appreciate it, Mike. And that somebody would be Kit, who is up next. Good morning, Kit.
Hey, Bob. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How about you?
Doing wonderful. I've actually got two questions for you. The first one is, I know you said in the past that some hay has some herbicides or something in it that can kill other plants. Well, I put hay in the bottom of my chicken coop, and I use that and put it in my composter. Once it decomposes, is that still in there, or will that stuff carry through?
It depends on what the hay has been sprayed with. Unfortunately, the most common spray out there these days is something called Picloram, sold as P+D or Grazon, various different names, and it does not break down. It stays. In fact, there's nothing known to man that breaks it down. Most toxins. Now, other products out there, even your strong dangerous insecticides and things, they will be broken down. They will be decomposed. But unfortunately, the weed killer that many, many hay growers use does not break down. So if you want to do a test and see if the picloram is still in there, it's not difficult. Kid, take a 5-gallon bucket, stuff it full of that hay, and then fill it with water. Let it soak overnight, and then take that water out and find a broadleaf weed like a dandelion or henbit, something like that. Pour your water over it and watch it for a day or two. If the weed starts to get brown edges, starts to shrivel and die, you will know that that you have too much herbicide still in that hay. Now, the way it works, this herbicide does not kill grass, which is why they can spray it on the hay, but it kills everything else. So, just be very wary of it. And like I say, that is a simple test to tell if you've got a damaging amount of herbicide left in the hay. And a lot of it has it, but it's hard to find hay that hasn't been sprayed these days.
So probably not good a good thing to decompose and then, or put in your compost bin that goes in your garden then, right?
No, probably not. And now if you're using it as bedding, you say, for your poultry, for chickens and all?
Yes, exactly. Yep.
Yep. You can still use, if you can separate the manure from the hay, your chicken manure is still very much usable. The problem that so many people, the way people have just totally destroyed beds, is they've gone around and collected cattle manure and horse manure, and with these animals, that the herbicide comes right out the back end of the cow or the horse in the manure, and then everywhere you use the manure, it winds up killing everything. And as the, you know, as an environmentalist will tell you, the only solution to pollution is dilution, and eventually it gets diluted down to where it's not as much of a problem, but that can take years. I've seen people literally have to take all the soil out of their garden, out of their pots, things like that. There's been more than one compost company put out of business from selling tainted products, so just be very, very careful where you use your hay.
All right. And then my second question concerns leaf mold with all of these wonderful oak leaves coming down right now. So I've composted them in the spring, and that is pretty much now broken down real good. To make that into a valuable potting soil, do I need to add anything to that leaf mold?
Depends on what you're going to grow. In general, yes, I would add a few other things. I probably would add I like adding things like a little bit of green sand. I like adding a little bit of molasses. Frequently, I will add a little bit of lava sand to it. I think lava sand is a great, great thing to put in soils because it's hygroscopic. It actually attracts and holds water without keeping things just spongy wet. Beyond that, just depending on what you're growing, you can add a little bit of blood meal or bone meal. You can add a little bit of green sand. There are lots of different things. Zeolite is something that's becoming more and more popular as a micronutrient source. So those are all things that I would consider adding to it to make it into an excellent potting soil.
Okay. All right. I will start doing that then. All right. Thank you, Bob. That's all I had this morning.
I appreciate it. One other thing, Kit, you can actually, with your hay, you can actually do your picloram test before you put it out. In fact, generally speaking, you're probably buying your hay from the same source over and over, and they are probably using the same source on their hay. So you might test some of the hay before it goes into the chicken coop, and if you find you're getting good, clean hay, just, again, tell your supplier you appreciate it. Ask him to continue to get the rancher farmer who's growing that for him to continue to do it without the herbicide. And sometimes it's easier to know beforehand than to try to find out afterwards.
Okay. All right. I'll start doing that. Thank you, Bob.
You are welcome. And you have a wonderful Sunday out there. Let's go ahead and talk to Christine. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing pretty good, thank you. Two quick questions. One is, yesterday I heard you mention blood meal to keep critters out of flower pots and such.
Right,
And you said that dogs will dig it up. Will it keep cats out of your flower pots?
Oh, man, there's not much of anything that'll keep a cat.
Yeah.
Probably the most effective thing I've ever found at keeping cats out of flower pots is to get some lava rock. You know, not the real fine lava gravel, but lava is very sharp. It's very uncomfortable on the tender pads on a kitty cat's feet. And lava as a mulch will frequently keep the cats from wanting to dig in those pots. Unfortunately, the blood meal, while it works on raccoons and squirrels and possums and armadillos and things like that, the cats don't seem to pay much attention to it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they don't pay attention to anything. Another question is, I was looking up pond plants, and I found an article that said canna lilies. Is this the same canna lily that grows in the yard, or is there two different species?
There are more than one species. Just about any canna will adapt to a water culture. I like some of the smaller varieties. There are some variegated cannas that actually are grown, you know, more for their colorful foliage than there are for the flowers. And some of the more dwarf varieties. Now, the thing about any plant, as you've undoubtedly heard me say many times, is a plant grows a totally different root in the water than it does in soil. And so it's best not just to dig up something out of the yard and then stick it in the into the garden. If you go somewhere like Water Garden Gems, they're going to have some that have spent their whole life in water, and they will have some varieties that stay at a more reasonable size. But the other thing you can do is you can just take your canna rhizomes when they are basically rootless. In fact, in the fall of the year when you'll see them start showing up in nurseries, you can just cut off any roots they have. You can put them, you know, kind of right at soil level in the pot that you're going to put in the pond. And you don't ever use potting soil, as you probably know, when you're putting plants in a pond. You just use the garden soil because you don't want all the rich organic material in there. And you can start, and if you start them getting their roots established in water, then they will do quite well, rather than having to have a bunch of roots die and, you know, make new roots. If you're going to plant up cannas that you already have for use, I would do it in the fall and basically cut off the roots that are on there. But my choice, just simply because I think you get better varieties, is usually to head over to Water Garden Gems and see what they have already growing in pots for you.
Okay, awesome. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. Goodbye. All right, couple of open lines. Grab one if you'd like. 210-599-5555. I get to talk to you for a moment about the Cedar Eater of Texas. And you know, you've heard me talk so many times about all the damage that second growth cedar does to our hill country. It's just, it just takes away all the things we love most. Wildflowers won't grow under the cedar trees because it shades them out too much. We don't have nearly as much water coming into our creeks or down into our aquifers because the cedar holds it in its needles, catches and holds the first half inch of rain that falls. And lots of the year, we don't have any rains over half an inch. So basically, no water gets to the ground underneath those cedar trees. Nice thing about the Cedar Eater is the way they get rid of the cedar is with a machine that cuts it off at ground level, killing it effectively, and then grinding it into a nice mulch, all in one operation. That mulch helps improve the soil. That mulch helps hold moisture in the soil, and it does so many good things. Plus, you're eliminating the fire hazard that cedar poses and when the weather is really dry. I can't say enough bad things about cedar or enough good things about the Cedar Eater. Been at it for many, many years. They have other services too, taking down big trees that may have died of drought or oak wilt safely. They even have mosquito pulling the machine called the grubber that rips a mosquito out of the ground, roots and all. But the main business, still clearing the land of cedar. If you're down in South Texas and need to clear those senderos, of course, you know, that kind of brush may come back. But boy, talk about the easy way to do it. The Cedar Eater can clear miles of senderos in a single day. Learn more. Give them a call. 210-745-2743. It's 210-745-2743 for the Cedar Eater of Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Back to gardening on a nice Sunday out there. Just a great day for gardening. Warm enough that you can be comfortable. Yeah, you'll sweat a little bit. I'll be drinking lots of water with that good electrolyte called Ultima in there, but at least you won't have to put on a heavy coat to get outside and enjoy today. We're going to talk to Regina and Pat and Gary in that order. Regina is up first. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Great. I have a question about that kaolin clay that you had kind of recommended for the grasshoppers. And is it possible that I have grasshoppers eating up an avocado right now? Are they gone?
They are not totally gone. Their numbers are way down. But there are still some grasshoppers out there. I was out, you know, watering in my yard by hand a couple of nights ago, and flushed out two or three big ones. I've got fast feet, and that took care of that problem fairly quickly. But there are still some grasshoppers out there. So, yes, until we get a hard freeze, again, they're not the huge numbers of them that we sometimes see in July and August, but there's still a few of them out there.
Okay. Well, I was seeing the deer got a hold of three branches, but I was seeing some damage on another one, and I thought I had isolated them away from the deer, so I was wondering if maybe the grasshoppers. So the question is, I've been looking for the kaolin, and do you carry that?
We get a product which is the same product. It's sold under a different name. It's called Surround WP.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's a little more expensive. That's why I always send people to the hobby shop first. But if you can't find it, look for Surround, and it's
okay.
Fairly widely available. Yeah.
Okay, and is that 25-pound bag? Is that what you're carrying?
It's, you know, I'd have to go look on the shelf. I believe we have a little bit smaller bag. Not everybody needs that much at one time. Yeah.
Okay. I see that the use of it was actually even to kind of protect some plants and stems from sunburn.
Well,
Am I right?
Yes, the upside of it is it's almost kind of like a whitewash. It does create a bit of a film that can protect from sunburn. It actually can be, you can make it just almost a paste out of it and paint it on the trunk of trees in the hot summer months. Now, that's not going to be an issue this time of year, but the downside is it's not very pretty, so it's certainly not something you're going to want to be doing on your house plants, but it is the best way we have found of defeating the grasshoppers. But in all honesty, this late in the season, I doubt that they're going to do serious damage. Before you go to the trouble of, you know, trying to spray up into a tree, my suspicion would be that it's more likely caterpillars than grasshoppers. But I can't totally rule the grasshoppers off. Grasshoppers will typically leave a much more ragged, chewed-looking area. Caterpillars tend to leave a little bit smoother leaf surface, but in both cases they can devour lots of leaves. But I can't rule out grasshoppers, but I have to tell you I would be more suspicious of caterpillar damage, and those you can control pretty easily with BT with little molasses added to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And you mentioned that you do something that about salvaging the broken bags and the plants. If I tend to try to do that here and there, what is there a solution other than, or is there like a, what am I trying to say, like a remedy that you use when you do salvage some of those that are scratch and dent plants?
You know, that's a great question, but it's a tough question to answer. And it kind of depends on what the problem with a plant is. If a plant, you know, has root damage, let's say it's either gotten too wet or too dry, where you have root damage, Garrett Juice and Super Thrive are two products in both, and that Super Thrive, it's an interesting product, and the old man that invented it and sold it for about 90 years, I think, was one of the strangest characters I've ever known, but I have literally seen it bring plants back that I thought were dead. The Garrett Juice is also a very good plant reviver where you've had root damage problems. On the other hand, if you have plants that have suffered physical damage, in that case, it's usually, you know, much easier, and I just kind of trim off anything that is shredded or broken. Sometimes I'll use just a good liquid fertilizer like Has to Grow Plant. I'll make absolutely certain that I'm keeping the plants in the right amount of light, but plants that are physically, you know, damaged through a careless truck driver or, you know, somebody just knocking them over, puppy dog tails. There are many things that can damage plants. But in those cases, the plant has a good, strong root system. The plant recovers very, very quickly. So the answer is yes, there are many things you can do in a scratch and dent situation. I love that. I love that description. But you, first of all, have to figure out what the problem with the plant is, because you'll very definitely use a different technique where you've lost roots than where you've lost top of the plant.
Okay, so I wasn't so far off. If it is a root problem, we need to revive that, and obviously, and Super Thrive, you said, and
yes,
the Garrett Juice.
And Garrett Juice. Now, one mistake, and or, you can use both, you can use one or the other. One mistake that I see people make very commonly is they take a plant that has been shocked one way or another, and they immediately want to repot it. They say, oh, you know, I've been going to get rid of all that old soil and, you know, put new soil in. That's like having an operation when you already had the flu. That's real hard on the plant, and I do not recommend repotting a plant unless there is some sort of toxin in the soil, and that's not very often the case. So if a plant needs to be repotted, I always tell people, do what you need to get some new growth started, but don't repot until you see some new foliage appearing, until you see new healthy growth coming out on the plant. Big mistake to take a plant that's already sick and then put it through the shock of trying to transplant it. So when you see new growth, that's the point that you might want to consider transplanting.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Good questions. I appreciate the call, and I thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right, guess I better get a break out of the way here and once again get to talk about somebody that does great things for lots of people out there, and that's Sam Sitterly and his service, Green Grow Organics. Now, he doesn't have the kind of crew that's going to come in and do major landscape work and things like that. Sam's crew and he himself specialize in doing the things that really can make all the difference in how well your landscape does, like fertilizing, like compost tea application, like putting out the beneficial nematodes, or, you know, treating for the various problems. These are things that really need to be done, but it's good to have somebody who really knows what they're doing, good to have somebody that always uses organics to control problems, and good to have somebody that's not going to tie you to a long-term contract and charge you a fortune. Sam's been doing this for a lot of years, close to 30 years now, as a matter of fact, and everything he does is organic. He uses products that we would approve of and would trust very much, and, you know, again, he can do as much or as little as you want him to do. It all starts with free consultation. Actually, it probably all starts with you going to his website, which is Green Grow, spelled out G-R-O-W, greengroworganics.com. Take a look at the services he offers. Take a look at his many, many satisfied customers and referrals. Then, if you like, you can give him a call. He will come out following all the COVID guidelines and give you more or less an evaluation of what he sees that would benefit your landscape, would get things really looking beautiful, and then simply decide how much of it you want him to do, how much of it you want to do yourself. Lots of people do this. Lots of people come away very happy. Lots of people gain a little bit more time to do the things they want to do. And most importantly, your plants get fertilized and cared for at the right time. That's Sam Sitterly, Green Grow Organics.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening on a nice Sunday morning out there. It's Pat and Gary and JT, and Pat is up first. Good morning, Pat.
Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to you.
I have a cat question, and I heard the other lady asking, but mine's a little more serious than that.
Okay.
Cats have, for probably 3 years, have decided that the garden 2 feet from my front door is their litter box, and my front door and the mat, so they wet all over that. So the paint has peeled off my door at the bottom. And I've had, you know, 55 suggestions from people on the Nextdoor app, you know, none of which have worked. I currently have little plastic spikes in the garden. I threw away the rug and got a rubber one, and now they're wetting on the rubber one. You know, the other one was a kind of a, I don't know what you call it, like strawish, you know, that kind. Yeah. This one is just solid, just plain rubber, and now they're still wetting on the door and the mat. People have said, you know, get a water motion sensor. Yep. Well, that won't work because it would have to face my front door. I wouldn't be able to go out my front door without getting filled with water.
Yeah, it is. And it makes for a very humorous situation and a few funny at-home videos. But
nothing. I've put vinegar. I've sprayed vinegar. I've put cayenne pepper, mothballs, nothing.
These are your cats or neighborhood cats?
No, no, not my cats. No, I don't have any cats.
Okay.
Or dogs.
It's funny that they would spray. You know, I can see them liking that nice soft soil in your flower beds, but it's spraying the door of the mats.
Oh, I can understand that. And I, you know, when I got rid of that other mat, I cleaned the door all off. You know, I mean, I didn't use anything but water, but I used an old towel and cleaned the whole door and the threshold. And now the wooden threshold is all discolored because some of that seeps under the door to that, you know.
Yep.
And so now I've had that mat about a month, and everything was okay. And then now I'm noticing you can tell that, on the door, you can tell where they've sprayed it again. And it's wet under the mat because, of course, it's rubber, so...
Well, let's address the issue in the flower beds, first of all. And the best way...
I had mulch in it, originally. That didn't help. And the second day after I put those... did I say I got little plastic spiky things?
Yeah.
Okay. The second day, one of them... pooped right on top of that.
Like, take this.
And and then there's another part, there's a raised bed that goes along the front of my house and the porch, and at the end, so at the front of my porch, 8 feet from my door, I had enough of the spiky mats to put there because they started doing it there. And what they did with those is just push them out of the way.
Well, there are, as far as a mulch that you can put in your beds, a lot of people have been successful getting pecan shell mulch. I have a friend that went to a pecan cracker in Fredericksburg and got a bunch of it, and cats don't like walking on it. It's very hard on their paws.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing is true of lava gravel, and I've known people use both of those in their beds as mulch, and it encouraged the cats to go somewhere else. No one thing will work for every cat, but on your door, on your mat, cats in general don't like lavender. And many times you can get essential oil of lavender and spray around, and the cats will go elsewhere. Your veterinarian...
One thing I haven't tried. That's about the only thing.
Well, one other thing to ask a veterinarian about, and I may ask Dr. Kirby about that in a little while today, but many veterinarians carry a product called Feel Away, F-E-L-A-W-A-Y, like feline away.
Mm-hmm.
But Feel Away... is successful in getting the cats to go somewhere else, and it's not an unpleasant product. There is a...
This is at my front door, so, I don't want to put anything that smells bad.
That's why...
Critter Ritter. That didn't make a particle of difference.
And there's another stinky one out there by the Liquid Fence people. But try the lavender. Lavender is a very pleasant smell, and the Feel Away is not an unpleasant smell at all. And those would be my next stop at trying to figure out what's going to work. And let's try one or both of those and get back to me. And I'll, in the meantime, ask Dr. Kirby if there's anything new in the veterinarian end of the world that he has to recommend.
Yeah,
but those are the two.
I can't understand why my door is so enticing,
Well, the problem, I can tell you why your door is so enticing, is
it's red. Maybe they like red. I don't know.
For whatever reason, one cat went and sprayed the door. And
right.
It's kind of like,
right.
And you, and
that's
then
what people
every,
have told me, you know.
Yeah. And then every male cat right. that comes around right. wants to put leave
that's
his
That's why
scent
I got rid of the mat, because somebody said, you yeah. have to get rid of the mat. First, I tried yeah. washing it. That didn't work. And then, yeah. you know, squirting it off with water and letting it dry. And then somebody said, no, you have to get rid of the mat. So then I thought, well, what's the point of getting another one just like that? I'll get a rubber one. And,
yeah.
and for about, I guess I've had it a month, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed 4 or 5 days ago, they've done yeah. it again, you know.
Well, and ammonia is another thing that they don't generally like, but ammonia is not real pleasant smelling. Try the lavender, try the feel away, and I'll ask Dr. Kirby if he has any other suggestions.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome, Pat. Uh-huh. We'll okay. get to the bottom of this one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't want to have to buy a new door just because of cats.
I am not having the problem under control. I wouldn't suggest that. So let's try those and see how they work, and I'll look forward to hearing back from you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. Goodbye. All right, up next is Gary. Good morning, Gary.
Morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Doing good, doing good. Hey, I've got some flagstone walkway with a river uh-huh. rock in between the flagstone and my front coming to my front door. I've got
yes,
an oak tree right there. I've got just hundreds of little oak seedlings coming up through the river rock. I was wondering how I could get rid of those things.
Okay. First of all, unfortunately, they're not seedlings. They're not sprouting acorns. These are little growths that are coming off the roots of the oak tree. And they are a very common problem with live oaks, and there's not a real easy answer. The live oaks tend to produce all these little root sprouts in response to stress. And so the most common causes of stress in trees are, number one, drought. And these little sprouts are always worse when, you know, weather starts getting drier. And many times, if the oak tree, if the root flare is buried on the oak tree, if it's got soil piled up around the tree, this stresses the tree and will lead to an increase in the little root sprouts coming up around the tree. You can't use any real toxic sprays because you certainly don't want to kill the roots of the tree, because then you end up
right.
killing the tree. But
yeah.
you can burn the foliage off of those. The vinegar orange oil mix will not hurt the big tree, but it will burn those back. But unfortunately, it's a temporary fix. They will resprout. It's just it's part of having live oaks. But like I say, if there's anything you can do to reduce stress, like thorough deep watering, like maybe even using an air spade to be sure that the root flare is well exposed, those will cut down on the number of root sprouts you have. But it's not little seedlings sprouting up. It's just things coming off the roots of the tree. And this is the nature of live oaks. You know, they tend to reproduce. They form an interconnected root system, and if you're looking out at a mod of trees, you might think, oh, I've got 40 live oaks out there. In truth, you've got one live oak with 40 trunks coming up, because the root system just, you know, totally meld and fuse together, and when they sense a stressful situation, they just start trying to make new trees. So this is what makes them so hard to get under control. But those are things, again, try to eliminate the stress, and you can mix your vinegar and orange oil pretty strong and use that. That'll very definitely burn the foliage back, but unfortunately there's not anything out there short of taking out the tree that's a permanent solution.
Yeah, I wonder if, I guess maybe a pear burner, I could toast them like
oh,
that,
absolutely.
Maybe.
If you could do it safely.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, as dry as things are,
right.
I hate to use anything that creates a flame, but, yeah,
right.
a pear burner will certainly do, we'll certainly do a number on it, most definitely. But,
okay.
again, it's just a temporary fix.
Okay, well, I might try the vinegar orange oil then. All right, that's all I had. Appreciate it.
Good question always. I appreciate the call. Thank you, sir. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Yeah, I guess I better pause here and get my last break of the hour done. And JT will be up first when we come back. And I get to talk about Rhonda's Nature's Way, and I'm always telling you about all the wonderful supplements and vitamins and things like that. Well, I got a different product from Rhonda the other day. It's called Hemp Yay. It's a wonderful blueberry granola with hemp in it. And let me tell you what, this stuff is delicious. I really ought to be telling you about all the wonderful things that Rhonda has there that can help you with a diet plan, that can help you with some natural things, and you're getting some good supplements and absolutely delicious things as well. So walk a little further than the vitamin aisle and the supplement aisle when you go over and see Rhonda, because there are just so many things that she has, and I've just never known anyone who knew more about nutrition and natural health and things that you can do to hopefully eliminate all those little issues that we have in life, especially as we get a little older. Maybe it's sleep, maybe it's mood issues. With all this COVID stuff going on, they're natural antidepressants, and sometimes it just evens life out a little bit for you. And Rhonda certainly has things that work, has things that will help with digestive issues, sleep issues. I want very much to keep my immune system in top condition, because I think that's going to be the single best way to avoid getting COVID problems and recovering from them if you do. And I take a couple of immune support products that I get from Rhonda, and knock on wood, the results so far are very good. I just don't know anyone that knows more about helping you stay healthy naturally. And like I say, don't overlook some of the really tasty, organic, good food stuff she offers as well. Rhonda's Nature's Way, two locations, Southside Stores on Southwest Military, Northside Store there at the corner of in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan. Open every day except Sunday. You go find all the good stuff and check out reflexology. Check out the red light therapy. Check out the Beamer therapy. These are things we were talking with Howard Garrett about yesterday. Things that are medically accepted, proven results. And they're just some of the other services they offer at Rhonda's Nature's Way. All right, back to gardening. We're going to talk to JT and ET and a couple of open lines after that. If you'd like to get through, if you've been getting a busy signal, be a good time to dial 210-599-5555. And back to the phone lines, JT is first. Good morning, JT.
Hey, Bob, good morning.
Morning,
hey,
sir.
I need help. I need help with two things. One are Bodart trees and Phalaenopsis orchids.
very different organisms. What's the deal with the Bodark?
Well, I've got a bumper crop of Bodark apples, and I'm wondering, can I propagate more trees with those?
You can. Wait till they fall, and each one of those apples is just a solid mass of seed. They're a couple of hundred seeds, probably even more than that on there, but allow the apple to mature on the tree, and as it dries, it will separate. You know, they make kind of a sticky rosin, and but yes, you can plant those seeds, and you can grow new trees. They like a good soil that drains well. They don't really like a caliche soil. Where I see them grow in our area is along creek beds. My business partner has some of them growing right at the edge of the Guadalupe River, where that good old alluvial soil is there. But Bodark can certainly be grown, and it's interesting, as you probably know, it's a yellow wood, and it's one of the hardest woods known to man. Back in my college days, just a little aside, there was a whole line of old Bodark trees kind of off the corner of the campus, and for whatever reason, the city decided that they were going to go cut those trees down because they were blocking views or whatever. They burned up three saws trying to cut down the first tree, and then they just gave up and went away, and the trees won. So go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I was just saying, it's probably the one tree that makes a better post than cedar around here.
Yeah.
There's not many of them. You see a lot of them down around Columbus and that kind of place. But okay, I'll try some of those. I don't want a lot of them, but this tree's pretty old. I said, well, maybe I'll keep a few going anyway.
Well, they're a tough tree. Where my partner lives, she has about 1,000 feet of Guadalupe River on her property, and this kind of a terrace up above the river that gets flooded when the river does flood. And she's got boat arcs that have been totally toppled down to a horizontal position, and then they just sprout out and keep growing. And they are one of the real survivors in the tree world. As long as you have good soil for them, they'll probably last 100 years for you. So I think they're a good tree.
Yeah, this one's in river bottom soil, so that's why I'm sure. The rest of it, we got all hill country. Anyway, on the orchid, I need 201 or maybe 301 on these. We've got two plants. I've never had any, and my wife got from our daughter a couple of years ago two plants in little plastic pots inside a decorative container.
Right.
And they were, of course, loaded with flowers at the time. We kept them going for quite some time and watered them once a week to soak it and bring it out. Well, I started getting a little concerned what you were telling people about that potting medium breaking down.
Yep.
So I looked at it, and sure enough, it was. It was really kind of turning to mush. So I bought some of your mix there at your place, the bark chips and that kind of thing, and repotted them, and they're flourishing, still doing that. One of them is, well, they're both trying to put out more blossoms. They've since rebloomed and put out new spikes and all that kind of stuff. The old flower spikes are still there, and a couple of them are trying to put out new blooms at the end. But do I just leave those existing spikes, or what do we do?
Well, let's talk about how the plant itself looks overall. Are the leaves firm? Are they making good root growth? Do the plants look good and healthy?
Yeah, one of them in particular, they both have grown a lot in the couple years we've had them. One of them, especially after I separate, put them in different pots, is really doing well. One has bloomed since I repotted it. Mm-hmm. The leaves don't look as good as I would like for them to. And I don't know if I'm not getting enough water. I guess my main question is, how do I water these? I've done the same thing, trying to soak them every few days, but they seem to dry out quicker.
They do. They very definitely dry out more quickly in the bark mix. But with Phalaenopsis, they don't have any water storage organs, so they don't want to get totally dry between waterings. You probably have to water two or three times as often in bark as you did in the sphagnum. But basically, when that medium seems dry, or when you lift the pot and it seems a little lighter in weight, water it again. I'm watering my Phalaenopsis probably three times a week at this point, and feed regularly. Yeah. It sounds overall like you're doing very well. And the bloom cycle of a Phalaenopsis is such that they typically will form new bloom spikes fall and early spring. But if the plant is vigorous and healthy, that one spike can bloom, and after those blooms are gone, it may put on some more buds at the end, or it may branch out from dormant nodes further down the bloom spike and bloom repeatedly. And if the plant's healthy, nothing wrong with that. If the plant is weak, if the plant lost too many roots, then sometimes I don't let them do that. I go ahead and cut those bloom spikes off. But in general, I just wait until the bloom spike turns brown, which indicates that it's not going to do anything further, and then clip it off. And then, like I say, typically you'll have new bloom spikes form really November through February, or when most of them are going to begin growing. But
go ahead.
You obviously have the light down right. It sounds like your plants are doing well. In the bark, you're probably going to repot about every 3 years, but I just advise you, I use Has to Grow Plant, and I also use Medina's new fish fertilizer on them. But just feed regularly, water two, three times a week, and it sounds like you're doing pretty well with them, JT.
Well, they've got bloom spikes. Both of them have bloom spikes on them that are new. They're about almost a foot long.
Well, keep on doing what you're doing. You're doing the right thing.
Well, what about the air roots? Do you need to spray those between main water?
Tell you what, let me get Don to put you on hold. We'll talk a little more. This is KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
And there is one line available, so grab it if you like. We're going to talk to JT a little more, then to ET, and then to Jim. And JT, let's talk just a little bit more about Phalaenopsis. And what I wanted to go over is you were talking about air roots, so to speak. But the Phalaenopsis, the air roots are exactly the same thing as the roots that are down in that potting medium. Some plants make different roots up above ground, but Phalaenopsis in its natural home, it will be up clinging to the bark of the tree or the side of a building or somewhere like that. So those roots that are coming out up above are exactly the same roots that are down in the potting medium, and they don't know they're supposed to stay in a pot. Like I say, in nature, they would be most likely on the side of a tree, and those roots would just be going everywhere. So I just leave them and let them grow. It doesn't mean that the plant needs to be repotted. I definitely would not cut them off. In fact, the funny story related to that, I many years ago gave a Phalaenopsis to an aunt who put it in her kitchen window. Perfect place. Plant stayed in bloom constantly for 3 years. She came home one day, and a good helper had cut all the roots off the plant because she thought it didn't look so pretty in the windowsill, and it was 2 years before the plant bloomed again. So just it's perfectly normal, and those are the feeding roots of the plant. They just happen to be up in the air as opposed to being down in the medium. So when you water, when you fertilize, you know, just drench it over those things as well as the ones that are in the pot, and it does not mean that your plant needs to be repotted. The time that you will repot is when that bark medium starts to break down, which typically is about every 3 years.
So I didn't do wrong burying some of those roots down in the potting medium then?
Not at all. As long as you can do it without physically breaking them, you know, eventually you just have to plant that plant a little deeper and deeper and deeper, because it's what we call a monopodial grower. It makes a single upright stem. When you decide to try some other types of orchids, we'll talk about different things, but it sounds to me like you're doing a real good job of what you're doing, and I wouldn't change a thing except maybe water and feed a little more frequently.
Yeah, I've been up, but I've gone to twice a week with this dryer thing, but I think that's even not quite enough. So.
Yeah, right, probably not. Well, it's always a pleasure. You keep up the good work and call me anytime I can help. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, E.T. is up next. Good morning, E.T.
Morning, Bob. How are you today?
I'm fantastic. Sun's coming out. It's going to be a wonderful day.
Okay, I've got a question. What's the difference between a mosquito bite, a flea bite, or a tick bite?
Okay, a mosquito bite. I'm making notes here so I don't get confused. Mosquito bite, flea bite, and a tick bite. Okay.
Yeah.
A mosquito has a very unusual apparatus, so to speak, and imagine the mosquito has this long, in effect, snout that it sticks down into you. In order to suck your blood out, it is pushing a material. Imagine the barrel on a double barrel shotgun. That's a good analogy I hadn't thought of before. Imagine a small thing like that. And it's pushing material out of one side of it, which creates a vacuum, which sucks the blood back up in the other side. And so this is how, in more tropical areas, well, actually, when we look at diseases, that's how mosquitoes can spread disease. Fortunately, we don't have many diseases that affect humans, but we certainly have things like heartworms that affect dogs. And the way that you know, the animal gets the disease is this stuff that the mosquito is pushing down one tube in order to create the vacuum to suck up stuff in the other tube, and that's why you get that welt. And so that's your mosquito bite. Your flea bite is more just a quick withdrawal of blood. The flea just bites you and feeds on the blood that comes out of the wound. A tick bite is a much longer term thing. The tick bites, it embeds its head down into your flesh, and it will, in effect, withdraw blood for several days, you know, at a time. And ticks tend to carry some bad diseases too, both for animals and for people. But it's not that the tick is really putting a lot of material directly in like the mosquito does. The tick, the diseases that the tick carries are further down in the gut of the tick, and it takes a long time before these things sort of work their way to the surface and are transmitted into you or into the dog or whatever organism has the tick on it. The tick remains attached for a much longer period of time. It actually mates while it is attached. The little male ticks are very small. The female ticks can be, when they can be the size of an English pea when they're fully mature and fully engorged with blood. But all three of them are just nasty little creatures. All three of them can spread disease. The way that that fleas generally spread disease, it's not something that they transmit directly, but a dog or a cat or whatever, in trying to kill the flea and biting at the flea, many times fleas have the intermediate life stage, so to speak, of things like tapeworms that are in the flea. The dog bites the flea, the dog swallows the flea, and then the tapeworm starts growing in the dog. And occasionally, those tapeworms can get into people, most commonly little kids, where the puppy dog bites the flea and then gives the child a nice lick in the mouth. It sounds a little disgusting, but that's actually how children sometimes wind up with tapeworms, as it came from being kissed in the face by a dog who had bitten a flea. So I'm not sure how much of that is useful information to you, but you're just bringing up a few things that I learned through a few years of biology and a lot of years of life. They're just three different creatures that can cause three different problems in three different ways, so to speak.
Okay.
Does that help?
What's the best solution to relieve the itch?
I use comfrey. Comfrey, the juice of the comfrey plant is a great, great itch reliever. My grandmother used to use witch hazel, which is something you can still get. And camphophonique, I think, is another one that our grandmothers gave us. But my friend Rhonda over at Rhonda's Nature's Way, she actually has the comfrey in something that's called comfrey trauma cream or comfrey cream that has the comfrey in it, and it comes in a little tube, kind of like a toothpaste tube. And if you want to not have to grow your own comfrey plant, next time you're near one of her stores, get some of her comfrey cream, and it will not only take the itch out of a mosquito bite or a fire ant bite, it'll take the pain out of a wasp sting. Comfrey is just an absolutely amazing healing product, and it actually works. It's one of the best things that anybody has ever found to heal a brown recluse spider bite. It's one of the few things that works. Dr. Kirby can tell you about that. He had a recluse bite.
I've been bit by one of them before, too, so...
Yeah, and he went to a wonderful dermatologist who, you know, took out a lot of the tissue, and it was continuing to be a problem. I got him to start rubbing comfrey on it, and 2 weeks later it was totally healed without a scar. So lots of good things to be said about comfrey, but that's my choice for taking the itch out of just about any kind of bite.
Okay, got one last question. I have some blood meal. If I soak the blood meal in water and spray my pepper plants with it, would that deter the deer?
I would just put the blood meal dry on the ground at the base of the plants. I don't think I'd be wanting to spray that on something I was going to eat. I mean, it just depends on how hungry the deer are, E.T. Right now, it's so dry out there, and the deer are going to have a rough winter of it because there's just not a lot of food out there for them. They're going to be eating things that they normally wouldn't touch.
I know. Devastating everything I have right now.
Yeah. If you want to spray something on the foliage that'll slow them down, get the hottest peppers you can find. Habaneros are one of the more common hot peppers, or scorpion or something like that. Blend that up and spray that on the foliage, and maybe put a little garlic in with it. That's going to be the best thing I know of you can spray on the foliage that'll slow the deer down.
Okay, great. I got chili pepins, so I can grind them all up and put them in the smoothie. Okay, thank you, Bob.
Yes, sir. You're sure welcome. Thank you for the call. Goodbye. All right, Jim, hang on a second. Got to get a break out of the way here, and then we'll be back with more phone calls. And no lives, Don, run the recording, and we'll get back to gardening. All right. Back to gardening on a beautiful Sunday. It's going to be Jim and Manny and Emma, my next three callers. Jim is up first. Good morning, Jim. Hi, Jim. Are you there, Jim?
Hello?
Yeah. Good morning. Yes, sir.
Good morning. This is actually Manny. I don't know if the name got lost in translation there, but I've got a few questions.
Yeah.
Well, first off, I'm looking to build a strawberry box today, bare root strawberries, and I've never tried bare root, so I'm kind of just curious what kind of medium or soil you would recommend for that raised bed, and what can you share with me about bare root?
Okay, well, strawberries grow very easily as bare root plants. That's if you're planting any number of them, that's certainly financially the best way to go. Strawberries like a soil that drains well. They actually like a little sandier soil. That's why they do so well down around Floresville and places south of San Antonio. So if I were, if I were creating a bed specifically for strawberries, I would probably start with just a good basic garden soil, and then I would either add some coarse sand like sandblasting sand or maybe a little bit of lava sand. You want your strawberry bed to be where it gets lots and lots of sun. Strawberries are cold hardy. South Texas winters typically are no problem, but you're going to plant your bare root plants out there. You're going to space them out. I'd recommend probably about 8 inches apart. If your bed can be reached from all sides, you can just, plant a solid bed of strawberries. If you plant them in rows, again, I put the plants about 8 inches apart, and I put the rows about 12 to 15 inches apart. And there's no such thing as too many strawberries.
I've got a couple more questions, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Well, I have you on the line. Roses. So we had to put up a privacy fence not too long ago, and it significantly kind of cut down on the amount of sunlight that this rose bush was getting. Would now be a good time to transplant that, or do you think we're too close to our freeze date there?
Oh, no. Freezing weather's not going to bother a rose at all. I consider, if I had to pick the ideal time, best times for transplanting roses would be between Thanksgiving and Valentine's Day. But we've cooled off. How big is this rose? How long has it been in the ground?
Well, we kind of inherited it when we purchased this property, so we don't really know how long it's been in there. But it does look mature. It can when it, before the privacy fence was there. Fairly tall. I'd say it probably got up to about maybe at its peak, maybe 6 feet. And then, cut it back.
But it looks like a good, healthy plant.
Yes, for the most part. I mean, there's some woody stalks in there, as expected, but the plant is still growing.
Very good. Well, the most important thing with transplanting a rose is do not ever allow the root system to dry out. Have your new hole dug, dig that plant, and do not pass go, do not stop, do not do anything. Go straight to the new hole, put it in, fill soil in around it, and water immediately. I can't think of how many roses I've transplanted in my life, and I don't think I've ever lost one. But the secret is, and my old friend Alton Grimm is the guy that taught me this, do not ever, ever allow a rose's root system to dry out. You may need to cut it back a bit. I'd certainly take out the ugly old dead canes, but just to make it something you can handle, it's all right to cut it back a little bit further if you need to, and if you're going to, do it before you transplant, just because it'll make it a lot easier to do. But water it in with a little Garrett juice, a little bit of Super Thrive, and as long as you're putting it in a good sunny place, I give it a very high probability of surviving and probably doing much better now that it's out in a brighter place.
Okay, well, just one more thing. Actually, it's kind of related. I have a farmer friend who had some, and I wish I knew the identification, some kind of poppies that were growing out there several months to maybe about a year ago, and he gave me some of the seeds off the deadheads there, and I've kind of had them in a jar. How can I go about trying to plant those seeds? Is it best to try it in just some soil, or can I just throw it out, cast it into the soil outside and see if it takes?
Basically cast it into the bed and do it immediately. It's time to get poppies planted. Tell me about the plants that they came from. Were they big plants? Were they smaller plants? What color were the poppies?
They were fairly large. They were probably about maybe a purplish pink sort of color. God, I wish there was more I could share about it, but it was really a few months ago.
When you look at a flower, was it a single row of petals, or was it more double like a big rose would be?
If I recall, it was a single kind of structure.
Chances are, put them somewhere you like them, because you're going to have them from now on.
All right.
As you know, that little crucible look up on the top of the poppy plant, as you know, every one of those things may have 20 to 50 seeds in there, and they tend to resprout very, very easily, you know, whether you like them or not. And there's some great big oriental poppies that are more difficult. Usually they're salmon in color, and they're usually double flowers and much taller plants, maybe 18 to 24 inches tall. But what you're getting is just, you know, it's a basically a good old garden poppy. It's going to be one of the first things to bloom. The blooms don't last long, a couple of days at the very most, but they do tend to produce them very prolifically, and very few insects go after them. And so hope you like them, because you're probably going to have them from now on. There is a different poppy still, while we're on the subject of poppies. It's called a California poppy. This is a little yellow to orange poppy that is also very, very worthwhile growing. It blooms. The blooms last a longer period of time, and they are typically, even the plants may be perennial. The plant itself may last for more than 1 year. Yours, you can expect these plants to totally die out by midsummer. But they're going to make enough seed that you can now share it with all of your friends if they admire it. Okay. But, yeah, just basically scatter the seed out on bare soil and water, and the poppies will pretty much take it from there. You want to water pretty frequently. You want to water at least every day or two. Once they're up and growing, you can cut back to watering a couple of times a week. But if you like them, you're going to have a very colorful bed out there.
Would the same go for seed coming from inland sea oats? I know it's a totally different plant, but I also have some seed.
Inland sea oat's going to be, I would actually work that lightly into the soil. I would loosen the soil, spread your seed, and then just kind of rake it. You don't want to bury the seed real deeply. But, yes, you certainly can. In fact, if you want with your inland sea oats, you could actually start them in pots and then put them different places. But, generally they grow fairly easily from seed. But I'm going to work the soil a little bit more, and I'm actually going to cover the seed lightly with soil on your inland sea oats. And of course, as I'm sure you know, they grow in the shade, whereas your poppies want to grow in the sun.
Got it. Okay. And real quick, is there a native evergreen shrub you can recommend for full sun being blasted from the west?
Oh, absolutely. How tall do you want the shrub to grow?
Kind of, medium size, more or less a screen from a somewhat busy street. But, you know, if I were to guess, maybe about 10-15 range.
If you're looking for a hill country plant, evergreen sumac is going to be the one that will fit that bill best. If you would accept something that I think is probably even better, but is native to East Texas, the different Yaupon hollies. My favorite is actually called Pride of Houston. It combines evergreen with deer resistant, with beautiful red berries in the winter months, and it would make a very satisfactory hedge. And it is a Texas native. Although we don't have them really growing much in the wild here. The wild holly that we have here is another wonderful plant. It's called possum haw, but it drops all its leaves in the winter. It's Ilex decidua, whereas the Ilex vomitoria, which is the Yaupon, native to East Texas, but does very, very well in this part of the country and highly desirable, in my opinion.
All right. Well, that's all I got, Bob. I appreciate your time.
One other thing to consider.
Yes.
It gets bigger than what you're really looking for, but Mount Laurel can be a very beautiful evergreen shrub, but it's not going to stop at 4 or 5 feet. It's going to grow up 10 to 12 feet. And but where you're looking for native, it's a great, great plant.
Okay. We actually have a Mount Laurel that it's kind of in recovery mode. It had been sort of shaded for several years by a gigantic tree that they let get out of hand, the previous owners. And, that might be something we can move there.
I would not move. Mount laurels are very difficult to transplant from one place to another. Okay. They're as hard to move as your roses, easy to move. So mount laurels are fine, but buy them in a pot and handle that root ball like a giant egg, very, very gently when you replant it, and just a good plant.
Good to know. Okay, Bob, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Annie. Appreciate the call. Thank you. And goodbye. All right, let's get back to gardening. And actually, Jim is going to be first on this break. It's going to be Jim and then Emma and then Joe. So good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Bob. Can you hear me?
I hear you loud and clear.
Perfect. Okay, sometimes my reception is not so good out where I live. Hey, I got about a couple of questions, too, or maybe three, but I'll make them quick. Okay. I want to pour a concrete slab for our metal prefab building workshop.
Yes,
my
sir.
Predicament is the slab is going to be roughly about 11 to 12 feet from an existing young pecan tree.
Okay.
Is that going to be a problem?
I'll tell you what I would do. How big is this pecan tree, Jim?
Oh, it's too big to move.
Okay, no, I wouldn't worry about moving it. But
if,
you know, putting a slab over existing roots can be a problem because those roots can continue to grow and could ultimately damage the slab. The tree is not, if it's a very young tree and you don't have any roots, it's not likely to have any roots over where you're going to pour your slab. A tree's not going to grow roots under because there's nothing underneath the slab that it wants. There's no oxygen in the soil. There's very little water. There's virtually no nutrient. So trees don't tend to, you know, shoot their roots under a slab. But sometimes when you pour a slab on top of a root system, this leads to problems. And so what I would do, if this is at all practical, is do your slab like a builder would do a home. They dig a trench at the edge of that slab, which is called a grade beam. And I would dig a trench, whether you fill it back in or with concrete or whether you just fill it back in with soil. But I would dig enough of a trench down 12 to 18 inches that I have severed any root that pecan tree has all the way over to where your new building's going to be. And that way you're not likely to have anything ever cause a problem to that slab. Am I making sense? You know, it's not going to put new roots under there, but if there are any roots there to begin with down the road, that could be an issue. Does that make sense?
Okay, well, let me tell you this. I'm going to, on a separate project, I'm going to rent a trencher to finish a water line project.
Yep.
So can I just, when I have the trencher, even if the slab's already poured, can I just dig the trench at that point to cut any roots that
Absolutely.
Might exist?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's what I... Okay, because the canopy of the pecan tree, it's been in the ground about 15 years, is just maybe going to touch where the edge, no, it's not even going to touch where the edge of the slab's going to be yet, but it will eventually.
You've got roots all over there, but you said the tree is 10, 12 feet away from the slab at this point?
Yeah, where the slab will be, it's about almost, it's exactly about 12 feet away, the trunk of the tree.
Well, then you're not going to hurt the tree at all doing that. My arborist friends tell me that when you want to calculate how close you can get to a tree cutting roots without damaging the tree, they say take the diameter of the trunk in inches and convert that, take half of it and convert it to feet. If that tree, you know, has an 8-inch trunk, divide by 2 is 4. You'd want to stay 4 feet away with your trencher. In this case, this could be a monstrous tree, and if you're 10, 12 feet away, no problem with damaging the tree. So that would be, you know, that would be exactly what I would do. Now, for the benefit of other listeners, if this were an oak tree, I would paint any cut roots that I cut, because you could get oak wilt started in those roots through a root wound if the tree trench remains open for any length of time. Case of pecan tree, we're not worried about oak wilt, so you just trench along the edge where the slab's going to be, fill it back in, and don't worry about it.
Okay, that's easy enough. My second question, I need a hedge to, he's out there so I can't say too loud, block my neighbor's view.
he
doesn't keep up his yard. You know, I was looking at some standard Burford hollies. I've had Burford hollies at a previous house, and I really liked them. How tall will they get, the standard, and how far apart should I plant them?
They'll grow 10, 12 feet tall. If you want a dense hedge, I would put them about 4 feet apart. But tell me this, what part of town do you live in?
Oh, I'm between Lytle and Somerset and Pure Sand.
Oh, okay.
And they're
going to
be on the
you're fine.
West fence. They'll get plenty of sun, where they're at.
Well, I was more concerned about soil. If you told me stone oak, I was going to tell you find some other than Burford Holly. But, where you are, Burford Holly would be just fine. Other shrubs that you might want to look at, if you want something that's going to grow faster but be a good evergreen shrub, look at Xylosma. It's spelled X-Y-L-O-S-M-A, like xylophone, X-Y-L. Xylosma will grow about twice or three times as quickly as Burford Holly, and it'll certainly get up to that 12 to 15-foot height. And that's just one other one I would consider. But if you like big Burfords, just be sure you're not getting the dwarf. Dwarf's only going to grow about 5 to 6 feet, but...
I had those before as a hedge, as a foundation plant, and I liked them, but I need something taller. So that other plant you mentioned, it's an evergreen as well?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and it's spelled, can you spell it again for me real quick?
Yeah, X is an x-ray, X-Y-L-O-S-M-A, Xylosma.
Xylosma. I'll Google it. Google it while I'm listening to the show. Okay, thank you.
Very good. Have you ever been to our nursery?
Yes, two or three times. It's been a while since I live a long ways away, but I used to work at Fort Sam's, so I would come over there periodically.
Well, I'm not trying to get you to come over here, but what I want to tell you is if you were out in front of the nursery on Sunset Road and you look at the little strip center next to us, that giant plant that just totally obscures the front of that building, that's Xylosma. If you want to see a mature plant and see how big it can get. Now, you don't have to let it get as big as this one. This one's probably, 20, maybe 18 or 20 feet tall, and it's full from the ground up. But just if you come this way, that's you can drive by and look and see what a mature Xylosma looks like. And it would be, I don't know, it's just, I like big Burfords, and in the area that you're in, your soil's going to do very well. But if you start with 5-gallon plants, you're probably looking at 3 or 4 years for it to get up to that 10 to 12 feet height, 10 to 12 foot height. If you did the same size Xylosma, it'd get there probably in 2 years. So just depends on how fast you want to block that view.
Okay, on 3-gallon pots, because that's what I was eyeing this morning, how long would it take those to reach maturity, full height, like 10 feet roughly?
That a standard Burford is going to grow about a foot a year if you take good care of it. A Xylosma is going to grow 3 to 4 feet a year if you take good care of it.
Okay. All right. I'll look it up. Thank you.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you for the call, and have a great Sunday. Appreciate it, Jim.
You too.
Thank you. All right. Let's go ahead and talk to Emma. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, I have a couple of questions also.
Okay.
So, my first question, in my backyard, I have several brown spots, and it's just where grass won't grow. And
how big are these spots?
How big? Some can be like 20 feet by 4. Some can be 4 by 4. They really vary.
Okay.
And it seems like a disease or something spread because they're just all dried up and dead. But I'd like to recover them.
Okay. If you were to go out and lift up on the dead grass, do the runners lift away from the ground, or are the runners still firmly attached to the soil?
They're attached.
Okay. Because the most common cause for big patches of dead grass like that is going to be grubworm damage. And usually at least some of those runners will come up simply because the roots have been cut. So grubworm damage is the most common reason we see big dead patches like that. If they remain firmly attached to the ground, then you're probably looking either at a fungal disease or at a spot that's just not getting the water that it needs. In either case, you can, if it's totally dead, you may want to put either some little plugs or some actually new squares of grass in there. And this is not a bad time of year to do that. Even if it's grub worms, I'm not worried about the grubs still being in the soil. But most grasses,
hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me? Okay. grub worms are just the most common cause of problems, and they are when the June bug lays the egg in the soil. Then the little grubs hatch out, they eat the roots of your grass, and that leads to a lot of dead patches. Nothing at all wrong with planting some more grass this time of year. Put it very firmly, you know, stomp it into the ground, so to speak. Water on a daily basis until it gets some roots well established. Fertilize, and be a good time to get some more grass started.
Okay, great, thank you. And then I do have one more question.
Okay.
So I planted a dragon fruit tree in my yard a little over a year ago, and it just started forming. But now I'm getting a lot of lizards, like an overwhelming amount of lizards everywhere. And I was just, I'm kind of confused. So I was wondering if once the dragon fruit fully develops, will they turn into dragons?
I trust you're kidding. No, and the one thing about dragon fruit, even though it is a really neat and tasty fruit, is not cold hardy. So you and the lizards are both going to have some winter protection to get through the winter with your dragon fruit. So cover it if it gets really, really cold. But no, the lizards are going to be miniature dragons about 4 inches long and nothing to worry about.
Okay, great.
Thanks,
that really
Emma.
Helps a lot. Thank you. Thank have you. A good day.
You bye do bye. The same. Goodbye.
Well, I love her, but I love to fish. I spend all day out on this lake, and hell is all I catch. But today she met me at the door, said I would have to choose. If I hit that fishing hole today, she'd be packing all her things and she be gone by noon. Well, I'm gonna miss her when I get home. Right
now, that's another good one.
On this lake shore, and I'm
all right. Now, those of y'all that don't know, our wonderful engineer, Mr. Don Cooper Stevens, always finds us a fishing song for the last commercial break of the show. And, Don, I think that's a new one. I don't think we've heard that one before, but that's a keeper. We'll play that one again sometime. All right, well, I guess we better finish up with a little bit of gardening. We've got Joe and Jeff, and Joe is up first. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Bob. Wow, that's music to my ears.
Yes, sir.
So... Hey, I got a question. I have about a 10-year-old Meho Satsuma mandarin tree. It's on a 10-gallon pot. It's been there for many, many years. It's got a good 4-inch diameter trunk, and the tree is about 3 feet tall. From the bottom of the plant, from the bottom of the dirt in the pot.
Wow.
Every year I get plenty of little mandarins. This year, Bob, I got one mandarin, and this thing is as big as a grapefruit. What causes that?
Well, there are a lot of different things that can... did it bloom normally? Did it have a lot of flowers?
No.
Okay. The most common thing, and if you remember back, we had a pretty late freeze this fall, or this spring, rather. And what happens is those little buds, even if we can't see them, those buds are forming right now. They're called bud primordia. And if we get a real cold late freeze after those little buds have started to try to develop, then they just never even become flowers. So my suspicion is that a late freeze froze the bud before most of them could open. The reason you got a giant fruit is probably just because, you know, that tree basically had enough energy stored up to make, you know, 50 mandarins instead of just one. But because it only had the, you know, very few flowers, just one of them got pollinated to make the fruit, that one fruit turned into something of a giant. Hopefully, if we get back to a more typical weather pattern, you'll have lots of flowers this spring and consequently lots of fruit, but I doubt that you'll ever see a fruit that big again.
Okay, so my next question, I know the majority of the fruit citrus trees are grafted. I couldn't get the seeds from that one fruit and grow something that is going to put out fruit that big, huh?
You know, there's no way of knowing. A seed, no matter what the plant, is genetically unique. You can have 1,000 seeds from that tree, and every one of those seeds will have a slightly different genetic makeup. And there's no telling what you will get. The problem with growing citrus from seed is it takes 7 or 8 years before it'll have the first fruit on it. When you get a grafted tree, you're grafting mature wood onto a rootstock, and consequently, you can have fruit the first year. But if you were to plant the seed, you're looking at minimum 6, 7, 8, 9 years before you'll see the first fruit, and then you don't know whether it's going to be better than the parent, worse than the parent, or the same as the parent. So you can plant some seed from that fruit, but the chances of having, and you might get a tree that makes big fruit, but it's pretty long odds against it. The majority of those seeds are going to be fairly similar to the tree that it came from.
I see. Okay. Well, I thought I had something going on there.
Well, you know, if you told me that the whole tree suddenly reverted and all the fruit was that giant size, but it's a common thing. The what they call the football mums, the giant chrysanthemums that. Even back in my high school days, we got that giant so-called football mom around homecoming time. And, you know, the flower I'm talking about that's 6 or 7 inches in diameter. The way that they make that happen is they grow the chrysanthemum and someone does this by hand. They go off and they go out and on the stem of the chrysanthemum, they take off every other bud and they only let one bud develop. So instead of having 20 smaller flowers, you get one giant flower. And it's a fairly common practice. Your rose growers, when it comes time for a rose show, they'll cut off all the buds except for one bud on that plant, and that flower will end up being much bigger and sometimes much more intensely colored, and that's kind of what happened to your mandarin. It just put all its energy into making that one fruit, and chances are it'll go back to, you know, being the totally normal small
making
fruit.
Baby.
Yeah, the genetics didn't change, just the growing situation.
I agree. Well, if anything, it makes for a conversation piece.
Absolutely.
I took plenty of pictures. All
right, thank you, Bob. You got bragging rights, Joe. You get out and have a great Sunday, and let's get Jeff in here before the end of the show. Good morning, Jeff.
How are you doing?
I'm great. How about you today?
I'm fine. I had a question for you. We have a blood red orange. We bought an orange tree at... We bought it at Costco. It's about 4 feet tall, 2 years old. And 2 years in a row now, it's produced one orange, a delicious orange, but just one. And we're wondering if there's anything we can do about that. Or
move to McAllen, Texas, and plant it in your front yard, and it'll be much happier. Blood orange is a really, really neat orange tree. It's just not dependably cold hardy in our area. And it is a variety that doesn't make a lot of fruit. Now, are you here in the San Antonio area?
Yes.
Okay. You're going to need to protect it if we have really cold weather. And just as that tree gets bigger, it will make more fruit. But it's going to have to grow into, you know, a substantially larger tree. And that's going to maybe a little tough for you to protect. Of course, we've been having milder winters, so that may not be an issue. That tree, as the tree gets bigger, it will very definitely produce more fruit. But the reason you don't see a lot of them, and the ones you do see, usually the trees freeze back to some extent every year, which just keeps them from having a lot of what we call budwood on there that's capable of making oranges. If you'll protect that thing, anytime temperature is going to get anywhere near or below freezing, it will make a much bigger tree, and over time you get a lot more fruit off of it. But the issue is just you've got a tropical tree in a temperate zone.
What kind of orange tree would be good?
The so-called satsumas, many people call them tangerines, are totally cold hardy here. There is a little orange called a kumquat. There's a sweet kumquat and a sour kumquat. Those are normally totally cold hardy here. And the satsumas, they'll go down into the teens without any damage. But most true oranges and most true grapefruit won't take a hard freeze. But if you're looking for a mandarin, look for Miho or Sito. There's several good mandarin oranges that'll do very well here. And about once every 30 years we get enough cold weather that it might bother them. So they're a good choice.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, sir.